Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. It's our observance day, and so the bhikkhus have participated in the Patimokkha. Venerable Chunda chanted the Patimokkha, and we had some good discussions about Vinaya. And for the lay people who are staying here, remember that you're living by the eight precepts. That's your determination, to live by the eight precepts. And so we have a kind of moral standard and a renunciant standard that we all agree upon when we live in a monastery, and that makes life much easier, I think. In any consideration of the Buddhist teachings, it's always, I always emphasize in my own mind, there's the kind of social philosophy, or not philosophy, the social recommendations of how to live well in society, morally, to live by fulfilling one's responsibilities, to live in the caring for one's family, for one's elders, and to develop good skills in one's vocation, to associate with beings who are moral and wise rather than beings who are foolish and indulgent. And all these create a situation where it's much easier to reflect on the Four Noble Truths, or to reflect on Dhamma. So we're very lucky here that we have an environment where we don't feel threatened, where we don't feel we have to kind of locked in some kind of economic competitiveness, where we're safe, we don't have to lock our doors, we have enough food, and so that you think about just the safety and social framework that lived by. It's already very extraordinary, isn't it? Just very extraordinary. We have this opportunity to not always having to deal with the complexities of consumerism, or the complexities of hospital politics, or all these different things. And we certainly have our issues, as it were. We have our angers and fears and doubts, and so we all have our modes of suffering. But at least we have the safety to reflect on it. And reflecting on dukkha, reflecting on the First Noble Truth, requires some, I think, some sense of. It's very helpful to have some sense of safety, especially issues like fear. And if you don't trust anyone, you can't really open up to your own fears, look at your own fears. Or greed, like if you think someone's gonna take everything away from you, you have to kind of get like a squirrel and hog it all for yourself. So that good fortune that we have living this way is important to bring forth in the mind, because a sense of it's not quite grat a sense of the opportunity that we have helps us to see dukkha more clearly. It's not perfect. None of us are perfect, and I'm sure we could rethink Pali Buddhism and rethink the scheduling and all those kinds of things, but that would be endless. It's As in Lompo Samay used to, it's good enough. It's good enough. And that sense of, well, it's good enough, and I'm going to take responsibility for the suffering that I have in my own mind around this is important. Because without that personal sense of responsibility, it's just too easy to distract or blame. That's, of course, the default mechanism for much of people's suffering, blame or distraction. Neither of them work, because they just embed you back into the sources of suffering. So in a monastic context, we have our common agreements, eight precepts, Patimokkha. We have our sort of hierarchy, and we have a tradition from Thailand and India and Sri Lanka. And we have our duties and we have our responsibilities. We have the places that we live. We have a schedule of when we have our meals. So it's kind of really nicely set out. Now, you might not like the way it's set out, or you might like to tweak it here or there, but the very point of a kind of monastic form is that one can surrender to something which isn't of one's own invention, of one's own creation, and one has no longer has the freedom to manipulate the format. One has the freedom to watch how one functions within the format, how one feels inspired or uninspired, or feels critical about something, or disgruntled about something, or likes it or doesn't like it. So that's the freedom of, it's a different kind of freedom than the freedom of consumerism, where consumerism says that if you just keep consuming what you want, get what you want, then you'll be fulfilled. This is, of course, different. It's not that. Because our concern is no longer to seek fulfillment through consumption by getting the experiences we want, but to find a fulfillment of the heart which is not dependent on things, objects, consuming. So suffering comes within a context, doesn't it? When you read it, and like we just chanted the Four Noble Truths, there's no real context to it. It's an abstract. There's suffering, there's the cause. So the context is my life, my conditioned responses to life, what my bodily formations are up to, what the emotions are doing, my social skills or lack of skills. And that's the context, and for each of us is different. So you have to contextualize the Four Noble Truths, you have to make it relevant, you have to see what it's like for you. I was just talking earlier to one person, and been studying Buddhism for quite a long, 4 years, but had not really figured out how to use the Four Noble Truths. So I was just caught with very rigid ideas of sila. And I said, well, you've been studying for years and you've got an idea how the brakes work, but you're not very good at that either, but you don't really understand how the vehicle works. He didn't like that. That's a kind of rigidity, a lack of reflection, just taking a belief system. And Four Noble Truths is not a belief. So when you contextualize that teaching and you take suffering, you realize that's not a belief, it's something real. I feel some mode of discontent, some sense of lack, some sense of inadequacy, some sense of not wanting to be where I am now, some sense of not wanting you to be where you are right now. This sense of lack that we have an experience as human being is what we try to discern, what we try to awaken to, what we try to make conscious. It's a big step in humanity to do that. It's a very big step to actually come to a pure perception, a pure contact, a pure knowing, a direct knowing of the feeling of lack. Because whenever we have a sense of lack, that something is inadequate or inappropriate, habitually we try to manipulate the world to alleviate that, get what we want, basically, or get rid of what we don't want. And that's so quick that we project onto the world our stuff, as it were, and we're already caught up in that, the drivenness of our sense of lack. Comes as fear, comes as arrogance, or comes as shyness, or comes as fantasy, comes as sexual desire, all kinds of ways that it will manifest. But any time there's a sense of lack, whether it's intellectual doubt, whether it's whatever it is, the teaching is asking us to discern the sense of lack arising. I was talking earlier this afternoon about what discernment is, and just to go through that again, I'm sure you know, but again, it's just an English word representing something, but the way I see discernment is when I'm observing the breathing of the body, I can notice the sensations and feelings of the in-breath changing to sensations and feelings of the out-breath. They're different. I can discern that. That's not a thought. It's a noticing, isn't it? It's a noticing of the way things are. So this morning we were reading Lompa Samedo's The Sense of Realizing the Way Things Are. That's, I think, what he's talking about, very simply. Just realizing that this moment is manifesting in this way and changing in this way. That's direct knowing of and discerning this changing movement in consciousness. So that discernment is something we're constantly reminded of and we're training in. It's very simple. And just so I was suggesting this afternoon, when you do anapanasati, when you anapana, mindfulness with breathing, with in and out. So you're using this movement, this changing formation in consciousness to know suchness, to know the way things are, to discern the way things are. And the training in that then, in a kind of neutral format, allows you, gives you, strengthens you in the discernment of a sense of lack. So any sense of disruption, any sense of imbalance, any sense of alienation, and any sense of always moving into something interesting away from the present moment, always moving into fantasy, all of that, all those constructs, all those things that we do, we need to discern. We need to awaken to them. We need to know the way they are. So the first noble truth is I need to understand suffering. And the way you understand something is when you have the willingness to discern it rather than project it, run away from it, blame it, do something, manipulate the world so you don't have to feel it. When we try to develop, like in, say, if you're practicing anapanasati, and you try to cultivate discernment for long periods of time, it's very difficult for many people. Why is it difficult? Well, because attention is not strong enough to know the way things are. Attention gets kidnapped by dullness. That's common. So we had a snorer at lunchtime. So someone was, after lunch, doing some vigorous breathing and falling asleep. And I've known this person a long time, and they haven't figured out yet how to sustain the discerning mind around this hindrance of dullness and sleepiness. So each time this person meditates, they have the same breathing pattern, and then the same bit of snoring and waking up, and the snoring and waking up going on. And what's going on there is there's a lack of clarity, and that lack of clarity prevents the person from practicing discernment. So they have to discern the nature of dullness. And if they don't, then there's no stillness of mind to really look more deeply into consciousness. Another person might be just fantasizing making little wooden boxes. So there's that, and the mind that just wants something interesting, constantly going into projects or ideas or fantasies or writing projects or lustful thoughts or whatever, or old movies. And so this is the way the mind, then that discernment gets caught up with interesting and fascinating things. Might be a person I was talking to this morning, very anxious about some future possibility. They've been worrying it for 3 years now. 3 years. Same worry, yeah. Same problem. And I asked them, I said, do you think maybe your strategy's wrong? Maybe you should look at worry. So the person, the anxiety is so strong that the person thinks it's out there somewhere, this situation. And how will I solve the situation in the future? It usually doesn't come. So the discernment can't see anxiety as a movement, can't see it like the breath. And there's the absorption into that, like being caught up with that. Resentment, jealousy, these different ways that we are, our capacity to sustain discernment for long periods of time gets hindered. And so in understanding dukkha, what we're also trying, cultivate faculties within ourselves when there isn't much suffering, when there isn't much confusion, when life is just ho-hum and ordinary, like in a meditation, and trying to strengthen our capacity for discernment and sustain discernment for long periods of time. And that's a training that we try to do. So whether it's anapanasati or metta bhavana or something, how can we realize the way things are? That's very simple. Just the sound now. Temperature in the room. That's very simple. It's very straightforward. But then a challenge, okay, what prevents me from sustaining that discernment for longer periods of time? And I train in that. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, we have this sense of panya and samadhi and these different factors, being able to know the way things are for long periods of time. Now when we look at the ideas of dukkha, and the word dukkha itself, we have the idea of dukkha lakana, dukkha satcha, and dukkha vedana. And dukkha vedana is just the feeling of unpleasantness, as opposed to the feeling of pleasantness, sukha vedana, dukkha vedana. And that's quite natural, that's biological. So I feel hot, and so I switch on the fan, and that feels cool. So from the dukkha vedana of hotness, I get the more pleasant sukha vedana of coolness. Now, my fellow monks, three here, feel the cold very bad, so they might have been having sukha vedana with the heat, and now they're having dukkha vedana with the coolness. And fortunately, I'm senior, so I can switch. I can switch this thing on. But it's relative, isn't it? But that we can see going on in life all the time. Dukkha, sukha, dukkha. It's just the way, we're made up. Dukkha lakana is the characteristic of dukkha, and this is of course misunderstood a lot. And dukkha lakana is where you have to consider what the Buddha realized. And so what the Buddha's realization was, that the mind-body experience we have as human beings, and he defined that as the five khandhas, that essentially is something that is unstable, to some extent unpredictable, to some extent out of our control, and that if we seek to find what he discovered, the unconditioned, if we seek to find that in that which is unstable, then we're looking in the wrong place. So he said the characteristic of our bodies, of our emotions, of our memories, of our perceptions, of our relationships, of sense experience, all the rest of that, that is unsatisfactory in terms of his realization. And that's misunderstood because people take it absolutely that life is bad per se. And there you get this kind of interesting seeming paradox where sukha vedana is dukkha lakkhana. Yeah. I've been through this before, but anyway. Sukha vedana is dukkha lakkhana. In other words, sukha vedana, the feeling of coolness or comfort or beauty or satiation or whatever, its characteristic is that it's unstable, and then it eventually will move to its opposite and eventually die. And so that if we rely on the sukha dukkha, we're always compelled by those things, sukha and dukkha, we're always going to be missing the point. And so the Buddha asks us, well, if you're really interested in the realization I have, if you're really interested in that, you have to look in the right place. So when dukkha vedana comes up, then we enter into consideration about dukkha satcha, the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering. And here, what we're talking about is the misappropriation or the misunderstanding of the khandhas as something which is fulfilling, and then the kind of compelling nature of desire to always fulfill ourselves through the five khandhas, through emotions and memories and so on. And so when dukkha vedana comes up, rather than seeing it as something that's contingent, something which is dependent origination, dependently originated, something, and just discerning, well, this is unpleasant, it has arisen, rather than just staying with that discernment, our habit is then to be drawn to that unpleasantness with the desire to get the pleasant. And that's the cause. We go away from this discerning mind, we go out into the object with some kind of preference. And preference isn't wrong, but we attach to those preferences and we miss the discerning mind. We miss that discerning awareness. Can't sustain it. So we're meditating, and we don't notice it, it's so quick, but the breath or whatever we're doing gets a bit ho-hum, it's ordinary, it's not exciting, and then we get this brilliant idea. I'll make a box. I'll mill some elm. I'll make it this shape, I'll make it that shape. And that's sukha vedana. That's interesting. That's much more interesting. And then the design is, of course, brilliant. I only do brilliant designs. And then the bell rings. And the meditation's over. That's rebirth. Reborn into the realm of creativity. Or it might be something else that the dukkha vedana might arise as a possibility in the future. Like, I think a lot of us have suffered over worry about ticks, about Lyme's disease, or justifiably. So, you know, you're sitting here and you think, oh, this symptom, my knee's feeling aching. And we have friends who have Lyme's disease, and all of a sudden there's the fear, maybe it's Lyme's disease. That's a very unpleasant sense of discomfort, isn't it? And then logically have to do something about that. You need a blood test or whatever, but it goes beyond that, doesn't it? And the mind runs with it because it doesn't like that feeling of insecurity and fear. Then it runs with worry because somehow worry is going to figure this out for him. It doesn't. And then anxiety just drives the worry. And for each solution I get another worry. And it goes on and on and on. And that's attachment to the khandhas, to suffering. And yet one has to take care of the body, one has to have tick checks, and one has to be very, very careful. But the mind runs with it. An old memory comes up of something, maybe some lustful experience or a really interesting movie that one's seen. That's interesting. Interesting. And so the desire mind, well, like that. And it's not so conscious, it just happens, and the mind runs with that. So the way out of dukkha then is to try to sustain this discerning awareness for longer periods of time. And what prevents that is the mind going out into the khandhas, out into bodily formations, because that's what's attention, or let's say attention going out into these things and being wrapped up with them. And the incapacity we have to just stay home and know the way things are. And at some point, when you practice in this way, you begin to see that movement out into objects, out into thoughts, out into emotions, and you kind of get a feeling for that movement being, that's the problem. So I have this sense of lack, and then it moves into the khandhas in some kind of way to find fulfillment, but it doesn't work. Anxiety doesn't, anxious thinking doesn't work, lustful thinking doesn't work, resentful thinking doesn't work, judgmental thinking doesn't work, because it's just always being caught up. And at some point there is a sense of renunciation. There is a sense that being with the unpleasant and giving up the pleasant, giving up the pursuit of the pleasant, not as an absolute, because one still can have preferences, but just as a strategy for Nibbana, it doesn't work. You just see that. It doesn't work, it can't be. And there is a sense of, now what's important now is not the fantasy and not the anxiety, but the discernment, to just know. And that's you begin to employ the what we call Lakkhana Samadhi. And Lakkhana Samadhi is the capacity to sustain awareness through the characteristic of change, through the characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta. So now, as desire or sense of lack comes up, that suffering, it's dukkha in some kind of a way, rather than running with that towards thought and fantasy and projects and all that, one begins to discern, oh, this is the sense of wanting something. This is a sense of trying to go somewhere with this. And there's a wisdom, and from experience and through what one has learned, that leave it alone, don't go there, just discern it as something that is changing. And when that Lakkhana Samadhi can be sustained, when you can sustain the discernment of change around a sense of lack, around a sense of inadequacy, around a resentment of something, around some kind of lustful desire, around an anxious feeling, around just a really interesting idea, you can sustain Lakkhana, anicca Lakkhana Samadhi. So you you sustain the perception, this is changing. What happens when you do that? If your discernment can stay with the changing nature of something, what happens? Well, as you're emphasizing, you're no longer emphasizing the object, which is what desire does, you're emphasizing the awareness or the knowing. And as you emphasize the awareness and knowing, you're no longer drawn into the unsatisfactory, conditioned nature of the khandhas, and your mind opens to what is unconditioned, to which is not dependently originated, which doesn't depend on objects. But the pull of fears and desires is so quick, is so very, very quick, and so that we're kind of constantly caught up in the khandhas, thought through all kinds of ways. And when you contemplate that, then you begin to see that patient endurance, discernment with wisdom, are ways of developing our lives which are not dependent on the quality of the experience. So excitement and interest and success, these are dependent on the quality of our experience, but cultivating something like patience doesn't depend on the quality of the experience. It depends more like an attitude, a way of being with this particular experience, whatever the experience is. It's different. The capacity to discern for long periods of time, change, Lakkhana Samadhi, long periods of time, it's not dependent on the condition, right? It doesn't matter what the condition is, it's not dependent on the condition. The capacity to determined, aditana, determined to do that, and kind of putting that into the mind, doesn't depend on the quality of the condition. It depends more like an attitude that you're trying to bring up. The capacity to accept it all, like Lumpa Sumedho's line, it all belongs, to have goodwill to it all, right? It's like an attitude that you bring forth. And all these attitudes are not the same as pain and pleasure. All the bharami, all the sense of character that we develop in Buddhism, they're not the same as just being happy or unhappy. They have a more profound dimension to them. And you do see that, don't you, as you practice these more deeply rooted possibilities begin to be this really steady sense of discerning change. And the more you get into that steadiness, the more the changing things are no longer so bothersome, and there's less dukkha, there's less believing in that. So I think all of us who've been practicing a while, things that we found quite aggravating, you know, now we just can see maybe the remnants of that karmic tendency coming up, but now the discernment's very strong. This will change. And having bought into that so many millions of times before, say, I'm not going there. I don't believe that anymore. And we begin to have a sense of freedom, not because we've gotten what we wanted, but we now are no longer sucked into that whole vortex of wanting, not wanting. And then we do get caught up, and we do find, you know, we're just like caught up in our fears and confusions or whatever, and then it hurts. You know, it hurts, doesn't it, when you get caught up like that? And that's what we say, major dukkha that we feel. But somehow we surface, we get out of it, and then we regroup. Oh, my breath feels this way. And we come back to the same thing, the same simple principle, the discernment of change. It's very simple. And just to realize that, to kind of take one breath and just realize, this is discernment, this is awareness, to realize that, to trust that, to know that, is what we mean by bhavana, cultivating that sense of present moment discerning again and again, and to trust that. We tend not to trust that, we tend to trust desire. Desire feeds ego, ego feeds desire. And now we're noticing that, like mistrust, it couldn't be that, it has to be more than, I have to get this, I don't have to get that, no. Oh, that's a kanda. That's what it feels like. So when we train in our lives, that the capacity to be aware is not just a sense of like just being careful about not damaging the tools, that's important. Not damaging ourselves with the tools, that's important. But there's a deeper there's a deeper thrust to this now. It's not just about doing things well, because you can see people who might be very good craftspeople but who are obsessed with their craft. They can't stop, right? Or they make incredible things, and you see they're kind of compulsive about making incredible things. When that famous picture of Ajahn Chah that was in the Ajahn Chah anthology, it's a pastel that is at Chithurst, and the Anagarika, our first Anagarika who drew that, very good artist, but it was the first portrait he'd ever done. It took him 2 years, and brilliant piece of work. It's really kind of National Gallery standard of work. And Ajahn Chah was there 2 years before Jerry had taken the pictures of it. And he worked on it for 2 years. I mean, he was just so obsessed with it. And then he asked Ajahn Chah to see it 2 years later. And Ajahn Chah went up to his room and he looked at Jerry. He says, "You're very obsessive, aren't you? Obsession is suffering." And we were all just saying, "Wow, what a picture, man, you're incredible, you're great." Ajahn Chah said, "No compliment. Yeah, You're a per- oh, no, no, I know. I think you said you're a perfectionist, aren't you? Perfectionists suffer, don't they? So one way, you know, the world praises that, and I'm glad he did that, and I like to see beautiful things, but does the objective world then become a source of suffering? The opposite also, just it doesn't really matter to be sloppy and heedless, that also is a source of suffering, because it's not present, it's not really discerning. So we try to develop, like in monastic life, we're trying to develop that sense of discernment through the duties that we have, you know, just like sweeping a floor, or making breakfast, or cleaning the toilets, all the ordinary things, a sense of discernment, how does this affect me, how is this going on, so that the practical things we do, we're developing the same practice, awareness and discernment, discerning awareness. And then the physical work that we do, or the inner work of meditation we do, it's really seamless. It's not like you're doing two things. If you understand that sense of realizing, this is the way it is now, doing things very well for the sake of doing them well. In Lompa Cha's monastery, there's a great emphasis on craftsmanship. And if you've seen some of our bowl stands, very beautiful work, very beautiful work. And like Venerable Chun does, he's got a lovely one. And I've seen this craft develop in Wapapong over many, many years. And each iteration, each generation gets a little nuance on it, makes it more and more beautiful. And that can be a lovely way to develop parami, but it also can be an obsession. The other way is to never try anything and not be embarrassed by one's workmanship. That's fear. A lot of people do that. They don't want to make public anything, so they don't try anything. And that way, they're not embarrassed by anything. But that sense of not doing something because one doesn't want to be bothered, or one doesn't want to make a public statement. Like a bowl stand is a public statement. If you make an ugly bowl stand, all the monks are going to say, "Oh, your knife broke, did it?" we give Venerable Mudita Vihari a bowl stand. I think an elephant could sit on that one. It's huge. So you know, the design would be dodgy. But how do you learn? Like, how do you learn something? Well, you take a risk. So I'm sure the monk that made that one, probably everyone said, "Well, first bowl stand, huh?" But maybe he had the courage to do it and say, "Yeah, well, but still." And then he did another one, and then he did another one, and he did another one. He got better and better and better. And in the same way, the craft of the heart is that you know, you take a risk. You bring up things that are difficult, garbage in the mind. You take a risk and you flutter or whatever, but you get better at it, don't you? You get better at discernment. That's what you get better at. And as the discernment becomes stronger and stronger, these things don't have the power. So like in the beginning in meditation, it's like you're setting out on a journey. You're going to go canoeing, you're all excited. You're going to go for a 10-day canoe ride. You've got 10 days worth of food, a canoe. You're all up in Algonquin, and then the first portage hits you. And you've got to carry 10 days of food. You get this canoe in your head, and the mosquitoes have a great time because you can't even swat them away. And then you suffer through that, and then you go across open water, and you go against the wind, and you fight, and you struggle, and all that. And then in the end, you get that kind of feeling of just, there's the dock. And you just have to touch it. You're just going to float in. Float the canoe to the dock. And there's kind of many, you know, many intensities of experience we face as meditators. And sometimes they're just horrendous. You know, the fears that we have, or the misunderstandings we have, or the physical suffering we go through, sometimes they're very subtle, no big deal. But always the beauty and elegance of this is it's the same thing to discern change. They get better and better and better at that. So the discernment begins to dominate rather than the objective experience. The discernment begins to dominate rather than the emotion, the memory, the feeling, the bodily feeling, whatever it is, the social situation. Discernment is strong. And that's very peaceful. It's very adaptive. It's not dependent on causes and conditions. But the first step is the willingness to awaken to discontent and not project it, not seeing that it's outside being put upon me, but it's something that is manifested that I need to understand. Without that step, there's no reflection. And the one keeps needing to manipulate the world to feel comfortable and safe, which is endless, as it were. So I'll leave that for your reflection.
Antamayam dhamma gathaya sadhu karang dadamase.
Sadhu.